back in the late 4th century, in the early 5th century, there's a pastor in northern Africa by the name of Augustine. I'm sure many, most of you have heard of him. And in the first decade of the 5th century, he had decided to write what he would later call his magnum opus, his great work. And I don't think he meant great so much as in, you know, this is the best thing ever, but just the biggest work that he was going to do. And he was going to try to compile all of his knowledge into this one work. And there were two things in particular at that time that sparked him into wanting to write this work. The first thing was, this was almost 100 years after the Emperor Constantine had made Christianity legal in the Roman Empire. So it was almost 100 years after that, and there were Roman elites in the ruling classes, in the intellectual classes, that had seen Christianity now for some time and were ready to ridicule it, and had done so in some pretty major books, pretty major works of the time. They thought that Christianity was basically foolishness, and they couldn't understand how people were falling for it. And so Augustine decided that it was about time someone responded to these critiques. The second thing that happened that sparked his interest in writing this work was a little bit more of a pastoral issue. In 410, you'll remember King Alaric of the Visigoths strode into Rome and knocked down the gates and took over the city. Now, of course, by this time, the Roman Empire, the capital of the Roman Empire, had been switched to Constantinople, so it wasn't as if the Roman Empire fell in 410 when King Alaric took over Rome, but this was an extremely symbolic victory for the Visigoths, because for 700 plus years, the Roman Empire had been and Rome in particular, had been the symbol of stability, of power and authority throughout much of the known world. And so for Rome to have fallen was seen at the time as if the world was coming to an end. And in fact, many of the people to whom Augustine was having to minister thought maybe that was exactly what was happening. By this time, Christianity had sort of intermingled with the Roman Empire, and so the Christians of the time had wondered, if Rome has fallen, is Christianity going to fall with it? Are the two so closely conjoined and connected now that this spells not just the end of Rome, but the end of Christianity? And so Augustine decided that that also needed to be responded to. And he wrote this book. It took him nearly 20 years, but he wrote this book, and he aptly titled it The City of God. And in it, he argues that all of history can be told as an interplay between two cities. It really is a tale of two cities, the city of man and the city of God. He says that the two cities have been formed by two loves. The earthly, by the love of self, even to the contempt of God. And the heavenly, by the love of God, even to the contempt of self. The city of man prizes human wisdom, human knowledge, human achievement. But in the city of God, he says, there is no human wisdom, but only godliness, which offers due worship to the true God and looks for its reward in the society of the saints, of the holy angels, as well as holy men, that God may be all in all. The human city, because it chases after things of this world only, it is always unstable, always crumbling and having to rebuild, always fighting, always resorting to violence and corruption to get ahead. And Augustine shows this to be true, especially in the case of Rome. In the city of God, it is different, however. Or at least it ought to be. For Augustine realized that as humans on earth at this particular time, we are sort of dual citizens. We are citizens of both cities. We participate in both cities. But our primary citizenship as Christians is in the city of God. It is to that city that we owe our total allegiance. And it is to the completion of that city that all history is headed. So the city of man is unstable, and it will eventually pass away for good. It will eventually crumble for the last time, but the city of God will abide forever. And there will be our eternal rest. There God will say to our hearts, "Be still." There, Augustine says, we shall rest and see and love and praise. Now, Augustine got his inspiration, as I've mentioned, for this magnificent theme, the city of God. He got it from contemplating two books in particular. I mean, he got it from contemplating the scripture in total, but two books in particular, Genesis and the Psalms. And looking at our psalm this evening, I think we can see how. For the psalmist here in 46 develops the theme of the city of God no less beautifully, no less magnificently than did Augustine. Because Augustine got it from here. Now, much like Augustine, we find ourselves as well in a troubled place. This morning we thought about the various seasons of life that we often live through, seasons of various afflictions and troubles, trials, temptations, struggle, doubt, fear, even death. We are buffeted from without and often at war within. And so, to ask Francis Schaeffer's question, how then shall we live? How is a Christian to respond to life in such a place? And I think I can think of no better place to turn when wrestling with these issues, not merely wrestling intellectually, but really wrestling in our souls. I can think of no better place to turn than the Psalms. And in my opinion, Psalm 46 provides one of the most beautiful, one of the most eloquent and soul-encapturing responses to a troubled world that is to be found in the whole of the Psalms. How is a Christian to respond to life in such a place, in such a time as this? Verse 1, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. It would be difficult, I think, to overemphasize the power of this opening line. It sets the tone for the remainder of the psalm. As in a symphony, when the bass line remains constant and steady, against which all the fluctuations in the different melodies are harmonized, so also this first line rings deep and rich and true through the entire psalm. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The rest of the psalm is harmonized. It makes sense in light of this confession. For the Christian, this line, God is my refuge and strength, must be the cry of her heart in the night and the praise on his lips in the morning. The God we serve is the God of power and compassion. And thus he's the God of the refugee and the helpless. To us and to all who flee to him, he stands ever ready to be a refuge and strength. And this is why we need not fear, the psalm goes on to say, even if the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, even if the waters roar and foam, even if the mountains tremble at its swelling, we need not fear. Now, in verses 2 through 6, there are, I think, about three levels of imagery that are beautifully and frightfully even woven together. So the first level of imagery lies very close to the surface of the psalm. You have mountains quaking, you have seas raging. These are natural phenomena. And we are, of course, aware of the deadly force that such natural phenomena wields. Within just the past few months, we've seen deadly earthquakes rock central Italy, destroying countryside and towns alike, killing hundreds of people. In New Zealand, there was a 7.8 magnitude earthquake that lifted the seabed in certain spots 20 feet in the air straight up. We watched as the Category 5 Hurricane Matthew tore across the western Atlantic, leaving destruction in five or six different countries, taking the lives of more than 1,600 people. Here in the Midwest, my family and I have learned to take seriously the tornado warning sirens that echo out across St. Louis from time to time. Because the fury and the rage of natural phenomena can be awesome, as it can be terrible. Now, contrasted with this raging in the turbulent world is, verse 4, the glad city of God, which is not moved. The imagery, you can imagine it, is of a building so well built that after the dust settles there, among the wreckage, you notice it's still standing, none the worse for the wear. And the citizens in that building, having escaped the turbulent twisting and writhing of the earth, for they were in the building that did not move. Or it's of a strong coastal fortress, the waves of the sea crashing upon its exterior, but it holds. And those on the interior are not put out for all the raging without. And contrasted to the raging waters on the outside of the fortress is the gentle flowing stream inside the fortress, bringing to the inhabitants their life and respite. So that's the kind of imagery on this first level that this psalm brings up. The city of God remains glad even amidst the turbulent world because she is not moved, because she is sustained within, for God is in her midst. But there's a second level of imagery in this psalm, one of cosmic judgment. This becomes all the more clear when one reads different psalms, when one reads this psalm against different psalms, against the backdrop of other psalms, discussing God's creation of the world. So take, for example, Psalm 104, a great creation psalm. Here's what verses 5 through 9 say. He set the earth on its foundations, so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they took flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they may not again cover the earth. Here the psalmist poetically develops the Genesis account of creation. The water is standing over the mountains, just as in Genesis, the waters over the face of the deep. But God rebukes the water, and it flees to its rightful place. So this is God's creative act, setting things where they ought to be. Now, back in Psalm 46, that order is reversed, you'll notice. The mountains are no longer established. The oceans begin to transgress their boundaries. If the establishing of the mountains and the setting of the boundaries of the ocean speaks of God's creative act, as it does say in Psalm 104, then the shaking of the mountains and the bursting forth of the ocean signifies God's decreative act, that is, his judgment. Nowhere in the Old Testament do we see this decreative act of judgment more so than in the great cosmic deluge, the flood. The psalmist here dares to contemplate a world so unsettled, so unhinged as when under the judgment of God in the days of Noah. And yet, he says, even still, we will not fear. As those in the ark were carried through the waters of judgment in the bosom of the ark, so too the inhabitants of this city remain glad. For God, the Most High, has made this city his habitation. Therefore, it will not be moved. God resides in this city as a shepherd among his flock. And while his mighty waters of judgment crash on the outside of the city, there is a quiet river within the city, and he leads his sheep beside its still waters. He replenishes their souls. This psalm then provides us also with the imagery of safety from God's wrath, a safety which he himself provides. The city of God remains glad even amidst the judgment of God, for God has provided for her salvation, a salvation that is within her gates. And still, there is a third level of imagery provided in the psalm, and this is brought out most clearly in verses 6 and 7. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. And now the metaphor that's implicit in verses 2 and 3 becomes explicit. For often in the Bible, the uprising and shifting of the natural elements stands as a metaphor for the waxing and the waning of the kingdoms of the earth. And here in verse 6, it's no longer the oceans which rage, but the nations. It's no longer the mountains which totter, but the kingdoms. And history, of course, bears this out. It bears out what this psalm thrusts to our attention, the perilous nature of, the inherent instability of the kingdoms of this world. This is what Augustine called the city of man. This is the city of Cain, of Enoch, of Lamech, built on a foundation of a murder, a lie, and a boast. This is the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, whose prosperity led to pride and then to perversion, a distaste for the poor and the needy, and a gluttonous obsession with their own pleasure. This is the city of Babel. The heights of its walls erected in pride. They had no need of God, they surmised, but would make themselves to be God. This is the city of Egypt, of Edom, of Philistia, of Babylon and Assyria, who decided that if they could not be God, then they would try to beat him. They who filled their citadels with boasts and brags of their opposition to God Most High and to his people. This is the city comprised of the nations referenced in Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth have set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed one, saying, "Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us." And this is the city of Israel, not the true Israel, not the Israel of promise, but the city of Israel who thought that they had been, who though they had been given the oracles of God, who though they had heard the promises of God and received the covenants, yet they rejected their God. They maintained a form of religion. They looked for a time to be inhabitants of this city of God, but in the end they proved that they were not. The nations of this city, the city of man, do rage, as it says in Psalm 46 and verse 6. But they also totter. Why are they so unstable? Well, for one, because the more they rage, the more inherently unstable they become. The angry man loses more and more control with every new degree of anger he reaches. The world, in its anger against God, then turns its hating eye toward its fellow human beings, and consumed with rage, it totters and froths about in a stupor. And it's tragic. And history seems to have this tragic reel on repeat. Even more, the kingdoms of this world totter because, as it says in Psalm 46, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. God remains in total control. Psalm 2 continues, He who sits in heaven laughs. Like the waves of an angry sea, it is they who break on this fortress. Do you remember the speech of Nebuchadnezzar? The speech that he gave after he had attempted to conquer God's city? Listen to his confession after God had humbled him. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the hosts of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say to him, What have you done? And this is exactly what God declares in verse 10 of our psalm tonight. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. Now in our own time, the nations rage and the kingdoms totter. China continues to grow, continues to secretively and suspiciously build its military power and positions. Russia continues its rise and looms threateningly over its eastern borders. The Middle East, of course, is war-torn and war-weary. And there's a good many countries vying for power there and several others that are trampled and crushed amidst the jostling. In South America, scandal has been stacked upon scandal and corruption upon corruption, spilling down through society from the highest positions of authority. And here in our own country, we've seen our fair share of political scandal. Racial tension has again reached a feverish pitch. Injustice has been unmasked in all corners of our society, and oppressions of various kinds have been uncovered. We've just witnessed an election that in many ways felt much more like a civil war. At times like this, the church, the true church, may well feel like Abraham, pleading with God to stay his hand but for a few righteous persons, and yet there are none to be found in the land. The church, the true church, may now feel again the weighty condemnation delivered through the prophet Isaiah to the leaders of Israel in his own time. Your elders, he said, are rebels and companions of thieves. Your leaders are rebels and companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and runs after gifts. They do not bring justice to the fatherless, and the widow's cause does not come from them. The nations indeed rage. The kingdoms indeed totter. Yet just as in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, just like in Psalm 46, we may be assured in our own day There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. Friends, God has a city, and he has a people of that city, and we, the church, are it, and God is in our midst. This is the third level of imagery that the psalm evokes. It's battlefield imagery, a city besieged by another. Yet no matter how many troops pour against the walls, no matter how hard they pound the gates, God himself is our fortress, verse 7, and God cannot be broken. Before closing, I would like to raise a question which seems to me, at least at this point, needs to be raised. Perhaps you are thinking at the moment, is this city of God described so beautifully in the psalm really the church? Does it seem that does it seem to be the true church? It doesn't seem that way to me. I'll let the 16th century poet John Donne raise the question in this way. Show me, dear Christ, thy spouse so bright and clear. Show me the church that's supposed to be so bright and clear. What? Is it she which on the other shore goes richly painted, or which, robed and tore, laments and mourns in Germany and here? Sleeps she 1,000, then peeps up 1 year? Is she self-truth and errs, now new, now outwore? Doth she, and did she, and shall she evermore on 1 or 7 or no hill appear? Dwells she with us, like adventuring knights, first travel we and seek, and then make love? Betray, kind husband, thy spouse to our sights. How is it, Dunn asks, that Christ's spouse, the church, promoted at times in the Bible as being splendorous and beautiful, how is it that she stumbles through history, falling to decadence and profligacy on the one side, and destitution and harassment on the other? How is it that she speaks both the language of truth and of error so fluently? How is it that she lies ineffective and incompetent for so long? How are we to love this splendid bride if she is almost nowhere to be found? Well, we must remember at this point, indeed we must look in hope at this point, to the fact that the city of God, described so gloriously in the psalm, is yet to come in its fullness. This city is still being built. It is a spiritual city, built of spiritual stones, which you and I are. And like Nehemiah's rebuilding of the city, the building of this spiritual city, though it is destined to be glorious, is harassed all along the way. As the church, frail, feeble, often in error, as the church, we long for that city to come. Listen to how our brothers and sisters of the faith in the past also longed for this city. This is recorded for us in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. These saints of the past, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release, so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy. Wandering about in deserts and mountains and in the dens and caves of the earth. All these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect. How could they do that? How could God allow the church to be in such a state? He was, he is, as it says, preparing for them a city. So what is our response? Well, Hebrews 13 continues, "For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come." As Christians, we are city seekers. As Christians, at least in this world, we are city seekers at our deepest core and not yet city dwellers. So let us fix our gaze toward that city. In a sermon preached the same year that Augustine began to write his work, The City of God, he noted this to his congregation. This is one of his sermons on Psalm 84. He says, "When therefore death shall be swallowed up in victory, these things will not be there." These things being the troubles, the trials, the suffering of this world, the violence and corruption of the city of man. These things will not be there. "And there shall be peace, peaceful and eternal." That's what this psalm says in verse 10, when it says, when God says, "Be still and know that I am God." We often take that line as into our devotions. You know, it's time for us to come and be quiet and rest before God. But in the context of this psalm, that is God rebuking all of the raging and tottering of the world and saying, "Be still." As Augustine says, "In that city there shall be peace." God will have said, "Be still," fully and finally. He continues, "We shall be in a kind of city. Brethren, when I speak of that city, and especially when scandals grow great here, I just cannot bring myself to stop." Scandals may indeed grow great now in our own time as well they did in Augustine's. So my prayer, my encouragement is that we would heed his example and take the opportunity to cultivate our love for the city to come. And we may well find that in doing so, we actually become the best kind of citizens for the city that now is. Will you pray with me? Oh Father, you tell us in your word that great and glorious things are spoken of your city, of the city of God, and indeed they are. We pray that tonight you would ignite our hearts with a burning fire, with a longing for the city to come. And that longing would in turn be expressed in our obedience to you now. As you call us, as you called those Christians mentioned in Hebrews to go through all sorts of trials and troubles in this world, Yet as they did so in faith, looking forward to the city you were preparing for them, be our help and our stay, our guide, and help us also to look to that city as we continue on our pilgrimage here. We ask for strength and for grace that we need, and we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.